This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Is crypto perfect? Nope. But neither was email when it was invented in 1972. And yet today, we send 347 billion emails every single day. Crypto is no different. It's new, but like email, it's also revolutionary. With Kraken, it's easy to start your crypto journey with 24/7 support when you need it. Go to kraken.com and see what crypto can be. Not investment advice. Crypto trading involves risk of loss. Cryptocurrency services are provided to U.S. and U.S. territory customers by Payward Ventures Inc. PVI DBA Kraken. Visit PVI's disclosures at kraken.com/legal/disclosures.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Christopher Peter Davey, and I'm the Charles E. Scheidt Visiting Assistant Professor of Genocide Studies and Prevention at the Strauss Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Clark University. Welcome to the New Books in Genocide Studies channel, the New Books Network. I have with me today Claude Gatabuke, and Claude is a genocide survivor and Civil War survivor who has dedicated his life to human rights activism. He's currently the director and co-founder of the African Great Lakes Action Network. And Claude's here today to speak with me about his new book, Survivors Uncensored, 100 plus testimonies from the survivors of the Rwandan genocide, as well as pre and post genocide Rwanda, inspiring stories of resilience and humanity. Welcome to the New Books Network, Claude.
Thank you so much, Chris, for having me. Really excited to be here and honored.
Excellent. Yes, it'll be great to speak about the book. So it would be helpful for our listeners just to hear a little bit more about yourself. I wonder if you might introduce yourself and tell us about you and your work and involvement in Rwanda and the wider region.
Just real quickly, I was born in Rwanda. This is just to add to what you said in the bio. And war started when I was about 10 years old. Lived through that war for 4 years, and I hadn't been touched by the war other than seeing people who were injured and a refugee crisis that ensued, and the general insecurity that basically came out of, was a result of that war, and hearing about the atrocities that were committed during that war. I hadn't experienced it directly until April 6, 1994, when the Rwanda's president was shot on his plane, on his way back to Rwanda. He was with the Burundian president. And that four-year war was between the former Rwandan government, which was predominantly Hutu, and the rebel group called the RPF, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, led by Rwanda's current president, Paul Kagame. That war basically led to that genocide. The start of the genocide was started by the shooting of the plane, the president's plane. His name was President Habyarimana. He was with the Burundian president. And that's when I really was touched by the war in Rwanda. I was... at the time, with my mother and my two sisters, my father was not in Rwanda, we started hearing bombings and shellings all over the place, people screaming for help, dogs barking, animals making all kinds of noise. The whole landscape changed. The day after the shooting of the president, we started seeing gangs of extremist Hutus going back and forth killing Tutsis, hunting him down and killing them. So then we went into hiding. We ended up fleeing Kigali, which is the capital of Rwanda. And from Kigali, we went to northwestern Rwanda. As we were fleeing northwestern Rwanda, we were actually stopped at multiple checkpoints. And one of the checkpoints, we were asked, my mother and I were picked out of this pickup truck that we were traveling in, and we were ordered to dig our own grave. At the time, I remember a guy looking me in the eyes, and he says, "Say goodbye to life." And I remember those words. A crowd of people intervened. There were women, older men, and some children, and they started yelling at this crowd. Yelling at this group, and the group was distracted long enough for the driver of the truck to come back twice with two men that negotiated for us. And one of the men eventually said, after long hours of negotiating, said, you know, the boy and his mom are not going to make it 5 miles from here, so let somebody else kill them. Somehow they agreed to that, and we kept going. The war went on and on and on. We ended up with all the shelling. Again, the RPF Tutsi rebels, as they were taking over the country, were also massacring wholesales, you know, hundreds and thousands of people. And we ended up actually fleeing Rwanda into Congo. We got into Congo. It was a terrible, we were homeless. My own story, we were completely homeless. We had nothing other than a spoon, a plate, a pot, and a cup. That's all the belongings we had between myself, my mom, and my two sisters. The sanitary conditions were terrible. Many people, thousands of people were dying daily as a result of disease. And also the town of Goma was shelled by the RPF actually after we crossed over. And so they were launching bombs into a crowd of over a million people, because there were more than 2 million people that crossed the border into the Congo. When I crossed into Congo, I ended up rescued out of the Congo by some American aid workers that took us to Uganda. Eventually, we were trying to get a visa to come and join my father in the U.S. and that didn't work. So we ended up in Kenya, and from Kenya we came to the U.S. And so my story continued. I actually was afraid of my own story. I didn't want to share the story. And for years, I really tried to stay away and try to be another person other than myself. And it wasn't until I was in college that I read the book of Frederick Douglass. An enslaved African-American who was sold into slavery at 7 years old, taught himself how to read and write, and freed himself at 21, and did so much work through storytelling and sharing his own story, that he was able to not only free so many other people, but also was a great contributor to the abolition of slavery. And it reminded me of the time when we had been ordered to dig our own grave, and my wish for the world to know our story, to know what happened. And at that time, I felt that I had betrayed my own story. I had betrayed my own wish. And I was inspired to actually start speaking and sharing my story. And when I started doing it, there were atrocities taking place in the Congo. So I started with the goal of sharing with the world what happens to children when war and genocide happens. And so I was very, very, I had so much empathy and compassion for children in the Congo who were going through this. And what happened in the Congo basically was Rwanda and Uganda invaded the Congo. They actually went and massacred those refugees that I fled Rwanda with. They also committed a genocide. This is the RPF in the Congo. And this has resulted in the death of more than 6 million people in the Congo. 6 million Congolese people, people who had nothing to do with the things that happened in Rwanda. So I wanted to tell those stories. Eventually, my story caught on, and I started getting invited to speak at places and share my story. Again, mostly focusing on stories of children. And eventually we formed, I co-founded the African Great Lakes Action Network with other survivors of genocides or descendants of other genocides. that are, you know, previous genocides. So then we started, you know, our goal was to really bring peace, justice, and prosperity to the Great Lakes region of Africa, which is still the case right now. It's one of the richest parts of the world in terms of natural resources, but where people are poorest in the world. And the part of that is because there is conflict, there is war, there is genocide, there is mass atrocities, there is especially impunity. And impunity is why we want to see justice, because we believe that through truth-telling, justice, that we can actually achieve lasting peace in the region. And lasting peace is going to lead to prosperity, even though it's a highly exploited region of the world. So that is how I got into this. And then eventually, I also was a part of a group, which is the authors of this book, Survivors Uncensored, the group Ribara Wariraye, which is basically a platform that means the person who's lived through the night is best placed to actually tell the story of what happened during that night. We want to empower people to tell their own stories, to share their own stories, and that is how this book came about. It was for people who've been censored for many years, which is part of basically what happens in the region, and especially in Rwanda. There is an official narrative that was crafted by the RPF, the government in Rwanda now, and you better not deviate from that. And if you do, there are consequences. People are jailed, people are, you know, killed, and many people have ran into exile because they have spoken up and shared stories that the government does not want them to share. So we provided and created a platform where people can speak freely and speak uncensored and share any parts of the story that they would like to share. That is how we came about. That's a little bit of my background and how I became one of the co-authors of this book.
Great. Thank you. And it's really helpful to have that background for you personally, how you've sort of been on that journey of reflection, thinking about your own experiences and exposure to genocide and civil war. You've mentioned the book a little bit here. I wonder if you might be able to tell us a little bit more about what the book is about. What are some of the kinds of accounts that you have in there, and what a little bit more about what the purpose was in publishing the book?
So let me start with the purpose of publishing the book. We have a motto, which is the world must know. And so we wanted to share these stories with the world, which is one of the reasons why we wrote the book in English and French, two of the most widely spoken and read languages in the world. So that's one. Secondly, we wanted to empower people to be able to give a platform and a way for them to actually share and let the world know what actually happened to them without anybody telling them these are parts of the stories that you're allowed to share, and these are parts of your story that you're not allowed to share. The structure of the book itself, we did short stories. So none of the stories that are in the book are the complete account of any individual. We basically we wanted to do at least 100. So we did a little bit over 100. It's 106 stories in the book. And it covers from way back during pre-colonial Rwanda, like people's families, what happened to people's families in pre-colonial Rwanda, to the people who fled in the late 50s, fleeing during the social revolution that took place in the late 50s, early 60s, who actually, some of them were fighters in the RPF, the rebel group that I referred to, who are now the official government of Rwanda. They are people who were affected by the wars, the war, especially in the north of Rwanda between 1990 and 94. There are people who survived the genocide of Tutsis in 1994. There are people who survived the atrocities in the Congo, people who survived genocide of Hutu people in the Congo or in Rwanda, where, you know, these are all ethnic cleansing campaigns that I'm talking about when I refer to genocide and other massacres. There are also accounts of what is happening in modern Rwanda, things like the indoctrination of young people, the things that they are forced to do in order to graduate. You know, you have to be a part of the system and agree to be a part of their propaganda machine, for example, in order to graduate high school. We have accounts, those type of accounts. We have accounts of women who have been asked or been used as witnesses in courts, using sexual favors. People who there are accounts of what's happening with young people in Rwanda today, where especially for young women, people are made to give sexual favors to hiring managers and things like that. So there are so many topics and so many areas that are covered. Enforced disappearance, which is one of the biggest epidemics in Rwanda, where people disappear and you never know whatever happened to them. And it is a well-known practice by the government of Rwanda. So there are so many things that are covered in this book. But for the most part, the other big thing is that the book shows resilience by the survivors who tell these stories. The healing that they have gone through. Many people who have survived, they're torture survivors, and they're still telling these stories and are determined to share these stories, because again, one of the purposes is not simply just to share the stories, but we believe that through truth telling, we can actually achieve justice. And by the way, by sharing our own stories and telling our own stories uncensored, unfiltered, we are giving justice to our stories. We're giving justice to the people who are supposed to have been forgotten and completely erased and totally silenced. We believe that by giving everyone that voice, that we are paving a road to eventual justice. We are also taking part in restorative justice in that process. So there's two versions of justice that we are part of, basically, by doing this. One is restorative justice, where we are healing and we are restoring our stories and telling our stories the way they happened. The second part, and putting the truth out there, the second part is that we're also documenting evidence of those crimes, where eventually some of the biggest perpetrators, when they face justice, that there will be witnesses, and that in the end, the end of impunity is what is going to bring lasting peace. So that was our purpose. That's the content. Some of the stories are from people as interesting as Kagame's former bodyguards, for example. And others are from, you know, we've got a mixture of people who lived in the cities, people who lived in villages, people of all kinds of backgrounds, all from Rwandan backgrounds, ethnic, all ethnic groups mixed in the book, all of a variety of experiences, things that some of the authors, for example, thought, you know, I had never heard of these type of stories, and they got to see them. We get to be basically one big family of survivors who are uncensored and are helping ourselves heal, but also healing others, and eventually from one person to a community to a nation, we're all healing.
Thank you. You mentioned in the title and as you're describing it, this idea of survivor is sort of the main label, if you will, for folks who participated in the book and how they're reflecting on their own experiences. For you, what's the importance of using the word survivor instead of, say, your victim or perpetrator in the context of these stories?
The reason that we refer to ourselves as survivors versus victims versus using victims and versus using perpetrators. We do refer to the perpetrators in the book, in you know, various individuals talk about the perpetrators of you know, who killed their families and their loved ones and things like that. And we recognize that there are victims, but for us who are here and for us who are willing and have worked up the courage to actually speak up about it, you know, at one point we were victims of these things, but once we started to speak, once we started owning our own stories, then we became survivors, because the experience itself, making it out alive, makes you a survivor technically, but it's also a state of being for us, you know. It means that, you know, these experiences, though we still live with them, we still live with the nightmares, we still live with the PTSD and everything, these experiences are not they're not our full identity. They're not our complete identity. We are more than what's happened to us. And we are going to do more than what has happened to us. Of course, I don't mean that we're going to harm anybody, but we are going to do better. We know that for us, that term survivors means that we're no longer victims, in the sense of though we have been harmed, our state of mind and our psychological state is no longer the victim state. We are in the state of restoring ourselves and restoring others.
Mm. Thank you. We might return to that theme a little bit later on, but I wondered if you might tell me a little bit more about the process of pulling together all these accounts and developing the book. It seems like it was a collaborative effort between yourself and a few other authors. How did this come about, and you know, what was the journey that you went on together?
A very, very interesting journey, and gives me the opportunity to actually mention the names of those my co-authors, whom I'm very grateful for: David Ndayambaje, Eric Ngoga, Constance Mutimukeye, Eugenie Janti, Patrick Rugaba, and there was also, of course, myself, and Delphine Yandamutso. And so it was a long process pulling this book together. The book itself started, again, with the platform, the Rivara Uwariraye, which is what chose as the author, that platform being created. That platform was created in 2020, which is where basically we all got together, many of us who are the authors. By the way, Oscar Nyangoga is the other author. I apologize for missing his name. We created a platform to share stories for people to come together. In Rwanda, there is kind of an apartheid, a memory apartheid. There is a way that people are separated on the basis of ethnicity, with the Tutsis being privileged, and they are allowed to share their stories openly. They are allowed, there is a mourning period for the genocide where only accounts by Tutsi people are allowed to be shared. Memorials only have, they at least recognize Tutsi victims. And so the rest of Rwandans, the Hutus and the Twas, are excluded. And we created that platform so that everyone can share their stories and everyone can share their stories openly and make it public. Because we believe that it's not enough to share your story one-on-one or in private, but it's even more important than that. It's even more important to share it publicly. So it started with that platform. Then after multiple, and we would do events in Kinyarwanda, because that is the common language that everyone speaks. and we would broadcast them over social media, mostly YouTube. And they were actually very popular. Ribarwariraye events are very popular events among Rwandans. We had a lot of attacks by the government of Rwanda because they didn't like the fact that we included people who survived atrocities that were committed by the RPF, that were committed by troops led by Paul Kagame and his generals. And we continued. And then in 2022, January 2022, one of the co-authors, Eric Ngoga, said, you know what, we've been doing this in one form, which is basically video and spoken, and it's out there. But it's only Kinyarwanda, and it's great, it's better. And we had gotten this feedback from others also, which is how we also had started in 2021 broadcasting these stories in English and French. But he said, we need to put them in writing because there are many ways to reach people's hearts and minds, and books are one of the ways to do it. So why don't we put some of these stories in a book? Then we got together and everyone actually loved the idea. Then we started saying, okay, so where are we going to stop? And so we started the challenge of, we need to do 100 plus, at least 101 stories. And we made an announcement. We said, you know, we're putting a book out there. We, you know, whoever would like to be a part of it, let us know. And so people started coming forward. There were people who had already given their testimonies in these events that also signed up, you know, and we basically then all divided up our roles. We had people, so you only see these 8, but there were many people who actually contributed. Part of the reason why some of the names aren't published is because they are in places where they're not safe. Some people are inside of Rwanda. Some of the people who helped us. Some of the people are in countries that are near Rwanda. And we know that by doing this, the government of Rwanda, if they found out who took part and they had access to them, they would definitely harm them, torture them, kill them, and, you know, do great harm to this and disappear them. This is something that they do all the time. So to protect them and to keep them safe, we've kept this confidential. We only share that we had participants not only who shared stories from Rwanda, but also people who actually helped us put the stories together. Who are in Rwanda. So we divided up the work. We agreed that we would write the book in English and French. But a lot of the stories were coming in a variety of languages. Some came in English, some came in French, and many, many came in Kinyarwanda. Some came in the form in writing, some came as audios, and some came as videos. And so there is a whole wide range of how we received the stories. And so there was a triage process. There was a group of people who would do the triaging. There was a group of people who would then structure the stories in Kinyarwanda, and then some of us would translate to English and French, and then we would submit them to editors. And the editors in those languages would do the editing, and then we would finalize the stories and continue that way. We also needed to do it very fast because we knew that once we announced that we were putting out such a book, that there was likely a likelihood of it being submarined, or that the government of Rwanda, which does a lot to disrupt the work that we do, would have done the same thing or maybe done something to disrupt it. So we did not announce it until we put our structure together, we put our plan together in early 2022. And we didn't make the announcement, the public announcement, until February of 2022, I believe, maybe March. And we kept getting more stories. And eventually we said, we have to stop. So we stopped at 106. And we will likely use the other stories in future editions of this book, which we're not sure yet when that's going to happen. Then There was the process of publishing, and there's a lot of work that goes into putting a book together. There's the design. There's so many things. The title, even just the decision on a title, everything was collaborative, and everything took seemingly a lot of time, but we also needed to release the book as quickly as possible. Our initial goal was to release the book by end of April of 2022. But we realized once we started writing and submitting to the editor that it was not going to happen. So the book came out on July 5th of 2022, after a lot of sleepless nights between all of the authors that were taking part in it. The thing that I noticed the most, you know, when you talk about collaboration and being collaborative, was how highly motivated everyone was. I know that the people who were summarizing the stories to make sure that, you know, we were able to produce a book that wasn't as large as three dictionaries, were going from story to story. And at some point they were saying, okay, I need more stories to do, even after we had done 100. The people who were translating, same thing. The editors, same thing. Although we started hitting a bottleneck with the editing because we had less editors than we had authors. And so that part also contributed to us delaying the release. But we really wanted to put out something that was of good quality. Of course, after we released the book, we realized that in the big rush to release the book, there was one story that we had agreed to release that we hadn't released. And so we actually revised the book, included that story, and corrected a number of stories in that book. So for anybody that's gotten the version that came out, the version after, I believe it was September 5th, 2022, the R stories were at the very top. You'll see it either says this story, the last story, 106, story 106 was added. And there are a number of stories that were revised, and it's marked in the book. So that was the whole process, basically, in summary.
No, that sounds really interesting. And it, you know, a lot of folks who do interviews and are interviewed on this channel or across New Books Network are involved, you know, academically in some way or another. But I think regardless of who one is and your background, right? I mean, the challenge of pulling together a book is such a big thing. And so it's helpful to hear about how that works from a quite a big collaborative perspective with, you know, the multiple number of authors and then the team of folks that you worked with to make the book happen. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about some of the challenges of bringing together, you know, what really is a global diaspora, because, you know, as you mentioned, you know, those living in Rwanda, as well as those in the region still, you know, places like Kenya and Uganda, you know, it's dangerous for them to participate in such a project. But then you also are working with folks, as I'm sure, you know, here in the US or in Canada, Europe and other parts of the world. What were some of the difficulties and challenges in kind of trying to bring together such a dispersed group of survivors?
Challenge number one was making sure that the participants were safe, those who are in the region. That was number one. Challenge number two was the time zones. As you said, some of us are in the same time zones or close enough, you know, being in the US and Canada and Latin America. But then we were working with people on the African continent and Europe and also in Australia. So that the challenge of even just meeting, finding the right time to meet and do whenever we needed to collaborate, that was challenging. The tracking the work, keeping everything organized, making sure that, you know, one of the things that we did was we obtained consent from everyone in order to actually publish their story, that they, you know, they explicitly agreed that it would be included. So there are stories that initially folks came forward and said, I would like my story included. And when we asked them to give us written consent, they didn't. And so we did not include those stories. So that was another one of the challenges. Basically, just making sure that we get everything in a timely manner. With the deadlines, adhering to deadlines was really important a really important aspect of it, because if we were loose with the deadlines, we might still be writing today, almost a whole year and a half later, or a whole year later. If we didn't adhere to the deadlines, some people would have gotten burnt out. It was a lot of work. I mean, people spent so many sleepless nights, hours and hours on end, to make sure that this happened, and it happened in a timely manner. The other challenge is the language. It's, you know, though many people speak Kinyarwanda, not everyone that participated speaks it or speaks it fluently, but also just going from one language to another. Sometimes stories, after we translated and went through it, they didn't make sense. And so we had to go back and make sure that the stories made sense, and that the authors of the books, the survivors who shared those stories, were, that they were comfortable and agreed with the content that was in there. The other challenge was the tools. You know, not everyone, you know, if we were talking, some of us, we have easy access to, you know, laptops and things that we can use all the time to do the writing. Some of the participants and some of our co-authors are in places where, you know, they needed resources. And so we had to provide resources to make sure that they could proceed and work efficiently. So there was all of that. The other was, the biggest one, I think, was actually us agreeing on what the cover would look like. So one of the biggest fights, besides keeping people safe, the safety of the participants, was consensus, coming to a consensus on, especially when people, we had gone for days and weeks discussing and evaluating and, you know, looking at things and saying, okay, we like this, you know, somebody says, no, this one, we probably need to do it differently and things like that. You know, coming to a consensus with the eight main authors, especially for the cover, was a challenge. At one point, we were actually really tired, and, you know, folks had said, this is okay, this is good enough. But then we'd say, you know what, we got to catch a second wind. Let's get it right. There is some dissatisfaction with this cover, and eventually we all found one that we agreed with. So our designer was excellent in making adjustments and changes and everything, because the concept that we started with was completely different than what we ended up with. So those were some of the challenges. The other challenge was doing it quickly. The timing, that was a big one.
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned about the cover, because I was thinking about that as you were speaking earlier. And for those of you who haven't seen a picture of the cover, I wondered if you might be able to just briefly describe the cover that you use, I think, for both the English and French versions. And, you know, what was so compelling about that image, and why you chose to go with that one in the end?
You know, it's the same cover for both, except the color. The English version is yellow, mostly yellow. The French version is kind of a brownish, dark green type. It's brown. It is brown. And the design itself, the image on there, is a woman carrying a baby. And so it's about caring. One of the things that we really, really wanted to shine through was about, you know, showing care for others. But also, a lot of the stories in the book are actually stories of people, stories that we lived through when we were still very young. Many of us were children. Many of the people who were affected were women. And so that was important to depict. But it also, we wanted to show hope. And also represent the region, And so the book itself has landscapes from the region, the green, the lush green hills and mountains, the lakes, the bodies of water, all of that is in there. And it's a beautiful region. And we wanted to also have that included. So the image itself is a combination of the woman carrying the baby, taking care of somebody that's vulnerable, being taken care of, somebody that's resilient, taking care of someone else. Resilience was a big theme that we wanted to come through, to shine through, and also showing what this, you know, the beauty of the region and the beauty that we are aiming for.
Thank you. That's really helpful. I wonder if you could just say briefly, and this is a bit more of a general question, what the role of survivors can be or should be in telling their own stories. Because, you know, oftentimes with, you know, these many books written about the Rwandan genocide and about the Rwandan story more broadly, are often told by, you know, people like myself who, you know, have been to the country and do research on Rwanda. And this is true, you know, of places like Bosnia and other parts of the continent of Africa and even in other parts of the global south, right? We do rely on outside experts to tell the story of survivors. So I wonder if you might be able to just briefly say a little bit about, you know, just generally what you think the role of survivors is in telling their own stories.
You know, you're taking me back to when I first started speaking out and first started writing, trying to publish articles. I was a really bad writer, too, by the way. My articles were incoherent when I look back at some of my initial articles. But then I started getting some guidance and folks would say, you know, focus on one thing. And then I would submit articles and I would get pushed back and they would say, yeah, this has not been published anywhere. Where is the source? And I would say, I'm the source. And and that usually was rejected. That's not the case as much anymore. But it's something that I experienced. And I think the more voices that you have from the survivors, I think it makes the story and the research more complete. It makes it richer. And it also gives a perspective, a direct perspective, a perspective from somebody who is directly involved. And I think it's important. So you're talking about, you know, books being written by, you know, in the academic world, you know, by researchers, also by advocates and things like that, and people, and folks like that. But I think it's important, you know, to always have that voice, the survivor voice, which brings a perspective where, you know, the readers of the book can basically say, you know what, the voice that's here, the person that actually lived through this experience that is in this research, is somebody that I can shake hands with. There is a human face to this. The role of survivors primarily is to bring a human face to these things, is to bring that touch of there is actually a real person behind this. This isn't just research. This isn't a movie. This isn't something on the screen. This is a person's experience. The other is that they add credibility to what is being put out there, I think, because, you know, if you do your research and say there was a bombing campaign in 1994 in Rwanda and I'm here testifying about it because I lived through it, I think it adds to what you're saying. Not to downplay the methodology and everything that goes into the research, but also I do think that having direct witnesses is very helpful. The other thing is that survivors, I think, have a big role to play both in healing, moving forward, and also I think it's a lot easier to move people's hearts and minds when you're speaking about personal experiences versus just research. That's my thoughts, and that's my opinion on it, that survivors really have a big role to play in not only bringing additional credibility to the research, but also to really humanizing the stories.
Thank you. Yeah, I think, you know, there is something very crucial about that. exchange and relationship between survivors and those who are seeking to tell their stories, and then, you know, the role of survivors in doing it, you know, for themselves. And I think, you know, interestingly, you've described, you know, quite a distinct, you know, methodology that you had in working from the, you know, those initial conversations that are broadcast online to moving towards the book format, which is something that, you know, it seems evolved quite organically, which is really interesting to hear about. You mentioned in our conversation already, different themes in the book, those that are in the title around resilience, and then some of the timelines and places that the stories highlight throughout the book. I wonder if you might be able to speak to some of the other themes that popped up across this collection of 106 stories.
I think the biggest one was, at least for me, it was the effect on children that wars and genocides have, but also the plight of women. There are so many stories that are difficult to digest on things that happened to women and things that children got to see. The other thing that jumped out is that consistently, you know, many times and often the stories are presented as, you know, savage Africans, you know, tribalists killing each other. But what emerges out of the book for me, what I saw, was that we, the survivors in the book, recognize that though ethnicity was used as one of the ways for the various groups competing for power, it was actually a power struggle. And it was a power struggle between two groups that were power hungry, and they did everything possible to either maintain power or to take over power. The thing that I think is missing, though, I think the missing theme is there is some parts of it, but it's not big enough. I don't think it's obvious enough to the reader, is the role of Western countries, the US, the UK, France, Belgium, and so many others. That's not in there. The role of NGOs, some of it is in there, but it's not very, it's not prominent. And I think those are things that would be important to include in future versions. But the biggest theme, you know, that came through was the effect on women, the difficulties and the work that it takes to heal, and to be able to actually come forward and speak. The other piece was that so many people were really just excited for having the opportunity to share their story, and they encouraged others to do that, and their biggest thing was that by doing this, I'm making a contribution to a peaceful, a lasting peace, a solution to lasting peace. They really have made a conscious decision to be a part of the solution.
Mm, thank you. I wanted to just kind of zoom us out a little bit to the wider region. Obviously, we mentioned earlier that you're a part of an organization that works around issues in the Great Lakes, and you, of course, conflict in Rwanda, you know, even before the 1990s was a regional issue. And so just thinking about the Great Lakes region in Africa, how is this book a model for other countries that have experienced these kind of layers of episodes of violence?
It opens, at least it shows others that don't let the, I'm going to use that word perpetrator, don't let the perpetrators have the last word. And it also shows that you can go from many, many, many near-death experiences to actually being able to reach the world and inform the world, because this is a model in the sense that the book itself is a model in the sense that this is a tool not only for education, but it's also for advocacy. It's also to inform. You know, I personally believe that there are enough people that care, and they care about peace for themselves and peace for others. But often they're not aware. And awareness, you know, people don't care because they're not aware. Many. There are people who don't care. Many who don't care regardless whether they are aware or not. But I think there's a critical mass of people that could help bring about change in any place in the world once they are aware. And so this is a model in the sense that when you take matters into your own hands and you actually start building on that critical mass, you can move people into action. The work that we do with our organization, the African Great Lakes Action Network, we actually do put a big focus on raising awareness, informing the world, getting to the masses, not only for people who are in the region, people who are directly affected, but people who are indirectly affected, again, because as you said, zoom out. When you zoom out of an issue and you're not, you know, mistaking the tree, missing the forest for the tree, you can actually also make an assessment and make a contribution. And we see this as a way to not just share our stories among ourselves and just be done with sharing the stories, but it's a way to rally the world to the real never again, if you will. You know, in genocide studies, you know, we talk all the time about never again, but never actually putting it into practice, that no one's going to be able to commit such atrocities and not be called out, even if they end up in power. And even if they end up being the hunter that tells the story, it's gotten to the point where now the lions are also telling their own stories. And so that's what we want the world to take away. That's what we want any communities around the world, be it in the Great Lakes region of Africa or elsewhere, who are affected by atrocities, people who may have been disempowered or censored, that now you can take matters into your own hands and you can start the process of actually accountability.
Mm. Thank you. So just to wrap up here, I wanted to ask you one last question about, so this on this broader scale. You described earlier about how, you know, the group moved from doing these online conversations and broadcasting to then moving towards the book. And I wonder if you had any thoughts or comments about, you know, different kinds of spaces that provide expression of memory for survivors, and, you know, what some of the, I guess, the pros and cons of using online spaces versus a physical book, and if those different kinds of platforms have different purposes, particularly for, you know, diasporas that are spread globally and have different access, different resources. You know, are there better ways of providing for expression of memory for diasporas?
Thank you for that question, because it gives me the opportunity to actually thank some of the organizations that have really been key to us being able to use these platforms. There is the HMG Studio, which is it's a studio that has broadcasting partners in various parts of the world where these stories are seen on various TV channels, but also they broadcast and stream on YouTube and Facebook, and they've been very, very graceful in giving us the space to use that platform. So I invite everyone to take a look at it, and possibly, you know, survivors from other parts of the world, also leveraging the generosity by the studio. There is also Friends of the Congo and Black Star News, who have been in our organization, AGLAN, that have put up resources to sponsor these conversations and to make sure that we're able to have these platforms. So the difference between online and written, physical versus virtual, is The cons. Let me start with the cons on online. There is the hacking. Constantly, wherever, and this isn't just on HMG, but many platforms in various parts of the world have told me that whenever we have conversations, they get hacked. You know, I've heard it from platforms that are based in New York, platforms in Nigeria, platforms in Jamaica, and various parts of the world. So there is the hacking, and there is the disruption that could happen by doing this online. The advantage is that when you put it out there online, for the most part, if you use platforms like YouTube and Facebook, it's usually free for the consumers, those who would like to see the stories, for the audience to experience it and see it. The other thing is the visual part. When it comes to online platforms, the person being there, showing their face, and you can hear their voices, is probably as close to in person as possible. And that is very helpful, and it brings a lot of credibility. Of course, people can make up things online, but for the most part, you're seeing the person, and it's easy to believe and easy to digest. You feel connected. But that's that also requires you being in a place or having devices where you can access those things. And then when it comes to books and publications, things that are physical, I think a person being able to hold it in their hand and being able to go to the park and, you know, they're sitting at the park and they just want to open it and read it, or they're, you know, laying down at home and they open it and read it and things like that. It's a completely different feel. And it also brings another level of credibility, because the way you tell a story when you're speaking is different than the way you do it when you're writing. And for some reason, it can both be captivating, but usually when it's written, it's a lot more, I think, and at least in my opinion, it's a lot more captivating when a person starts reading it and starts getting into it. I mean, I've found myself reading books and laughing out loud or crying. Of course, that happens also online, but it's not as easy to be a compelling public speaker as it is to write it in the book and make it a compelling story.
It's very true. in a lot of ways, it's very true. Well, thank you for sharing that and that insight. And I think that last question, I've personally been thinking about a lot recently in terms of, you know, what are the best ways to provide memorial spaces where stories can be shared? And I think this work is a really good example of kind of this dynamic ways in which, you know, different platforms can be used and approached.
Yep. And if I can add one, given that you're in a educational setting, things like, online tools like podcasts, for example, what we're doing here, you know, in addition to the other platforms that I mentioned, there are Twitter spaces and so many other ways. Those are all good tools, I think, to share with an audience, but also for the survivors and people who have stories to tell those stories. But also the other is considering, you know, guest speakers for lectures, you know, guest lecturers and things like that. They may not give a structured lecture to, you know, as you would as a professor, a professional, but they will add elements that I think are helpful in education. So there are many ways. I mean, churches can do that. They can provide platforms for memory, community organizations, and then there's self-organized things. One of the things that we did with this book in recent times was on January 28th, we actually held a book signing event that was three parts: book signing, conference, and a social. And it gave an opportunity for the public to actually meet the authors in an environment where you could just have a relaxed conversation. There was some structure, of course, with the book signing and the conference, but also the social allowed people the access to hear and speak to the authors directly.
Mm, thank you. Yeah. So we'll wrap up our conversation now. I have just a couple of last questions for you that typically on the New Books Network, we always ask folks that come and speak with us. I wonder if you might be able to tell us a bit about what you're working on at the moment or what you anticipate coming in the future for you.
So currently we are working, myself and the platform that we, the Rivaroy platform and my co-authors, along with other colleagues that are part of the platform. So one of the things that we do every year since 2020 is doing providing a memorial space, commemoration, and non-discriminatory commemoration event. So we are working on the one this year for end of April. And then we've already started working on the one next year also, which we're always working on innovation and doing something really impactful. And we're looking for it to be one of the most impactful events, and this is going to be 30 years, the 30 year anniversary of the genocide next year. So those are the things that we're working on. The other is we have requests to translate the book in other languages. So we're working on potentially getting the book into Spanish and Portuguese and Arabic, but also there's high demand for Kinyarwanda. So those are all the things that we're working on. Me personally, as part of AGLAN, we are working on we're working on continuing to not only raise awareness on the atrocities that are taking place in the Congo, but also really pushing for the implementation of the recommendations in the UN mapping exercise report, which is a report that talked about the atrocities and genocide and, you know, so many other horrible incidents. And when they refer to them as incidents, these are like large massacres. These are large, events that happened in the Congo that we want to implement. Because, again, we do have a goal to see peace in the region. And to get there, we believe that justice is important. Impunity has to end. And we are working hard at pushing to get those recommendations implemented.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. And so I'm presuming that one would be able to, any of our listeners would be able to see you on social media and find out information about these upcoming events, these memorials for this year and next year.
For sure, for sure. And I also personally have a lot of invitations to speak. So I'll be very busy at speaking events, and please do look out on social media for various events around in the US and also outside of the US. And also we have some invitations to potentially have these book signing events in other parts of the world with my co-authors, and some of them may be as early as May.
Okay, well, I will put a note on the information for the podcast, linking in some of your social media and a link to the book as well. No problem. The last thing I wanted to ask you, just as we wrap up here, thinking about your writing and your activism and your experience as a survivor, are there any particular books, films, or even plays that you might recommend for our listeners that have really influenced you in your journey?
Number one is Frederick Douglass's book, Escape from Slavery. When I read it, I read the children's book first, and then I read his book. That was the book that inspired me the most. His life inspired me the most in activism. So that would be the one that I recommend, the very number one that I recommend to folks to read. When it comes to books about the region, the book by Judy River, who is a Canadian author, In Praise of Blood, I find that book to resonate a lot with me. And for people who want to see kind of the inner workings of the RPF, there's a book called Do Not Disturb by Michaela Wrong that kind of is about the inner workings of the RPF. And so a little bit of the insight of the RPF. This is on Rwanda. But as far as an inspiration, definitely the Frederick Douglass book is the one.
Great, excellent. Thank you so much, Claude. So I've been speaking with Claude Gatabuke about his book co-authored with a group of eight other authors. The book is called Survivors Uncensored, 100 plus testimonies from survivors of the Rwandan genocide. Let me reread that. 100 plus testimonies from survivors of the Rwandan genocide, as well as pre and post genocide Rwanda, inspiring stories of resilience and humanity. Thanks very much for your time, Claude.
Thank you so much, Chris.